Weather Brains.
Hey, this time on Weather Brains, a Weather Brains Extra, low-down radar. The next generation hazard radar may be smaller and less powerful, but it may mean a treasure chest of new information to help us stay safe.
We are very pleased. I mean, the success is even better than what we had expected.
The 2007 Atlantic hurricane season is officially underway. Are we ready?
I'd like to think that a lot of people have learned a lesson after Katrina and Ivan.
We'll talk about it, and Brian Peters is already watching sea surface temperatures.
It seems like the Western Caribbean is also quite warm.
Also this time, politics and weather. J.B. Elliott's innocent weather comment that caused a firestorm that burned all the way to Washington, D.C.
The president of the largest chamber of commerce in the state hit the ceiling.
Plus, on Weather Brains 101, Professor Peters gives us a lesson on wet bulb temperatures. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray looks at one weather legend residents in Kansas had to learn the hard way was absolutely worthless. And James Spann talks about getting away from it all.
Everybody needs a break, even if you love your job.
And he may have found the best crab claws around. Find out where. It's coming up. It's episode number 71 of Weather Brains, the netcast that's all about weather, produced by the Weather Company. Hello, I'm David Black. With me for this ride, James Spann and Brian Peters. Hello, James. How goes it? How's your world?
Man, we might be the three best-looking guys on this whole show here, you know?
That'd be pretty sad if true. Brian Peters, you're with us, too. How are you? And where are you? What's up?
I'm doing great, David, and I'm happy to say I'm in Chicago, where I'm a good 20 degrees cooler than central Alabama.
Is it really the Windy City?
It was today. We did have a little bit of wind, nothing severe. But when you step off the bus at Navy Pier, the trees are bending a little bit, and it was kind of breezy downtown.
Well, I hear more people say Chicago is a fabulous city and hope to get up there sometime. I hear just more people say what a great place it is, and there's apparently just no shortage of things to do, places to go, people to see, and all that jazz.
Absolutely. My daughter and I went to the Chicago one of the museums here, the Museum of Science and Industry. And from the outside, you know, it looks like a sizable building. When you get inside, it is absolutely enormous. It's got huge rooms, and we did the CSI, the experience. And, of course, we solved the case with Gil Grissom and, you know, staff.
So you're getting to play tourist, and it sounds like it's a lot of fun.
Oh, yes. Having a wonderful time.
Well, that is great. And speaking of wonderful time, Mr. Spann, you have been doing a little bit of vacationing yourself.
Yeah. You know, I run pretty hard on this job between September and May. You know, no sleep and hours are bad. And I love everything about this job, but it's just that it can bring on a lot of fatigue. So when the May ratings are over, it kind of signifies the beginning of my little window of opportunity to get some rest and relaxation. So we went down to the central Gulf Coast for the past 4 or 5 days and had a wonderful time. You know, it's one of those vacations where I didn't know what day it was, didn't know what time it was, and quite frankly, I didn't care.
And you took in a few fried crab claws, I understand.
Oh, man, I could suck those things down. You know, Jimmy Buffett's sister, Lucy, has a place that for years was over on Weeks Bay, and recently she moved it to the Intracoastal Waterway in Gulf Shores, Alabama, and it's really become quite a tourist attraction, but they might have the best crab claws in the universe here. So,
well, let me ask you something. We have folks listening to Weather Brains, James, as you know, from a wide area of the globe, all across the country, even a few folks across the pond, as they say. So if someone who's interested in perhaps visiting the Gulf Coast of the United States, thinking about doing that, where would you suggest they go?
Well, traditionally, the big tourist areas are from about Panama City Beach, Florida, west to Gulf Shores, Alabama. Those beaches are just tremendous. They are just the sugar white sand. The water is so clear, and it's just a wonderful area. That whole strip, all the way from Panama City to Gulf Shores, and they all have their unique little, things about them that make them unique. Some areas are better for families. Some areas are better for college kids. But really, you can't go wrong anywhere in there. And we typically go to Gulf Shores, Alabama, It's just a place we've been going for years and years. And, you know, David, that place was hit hard by Hurricane Ivan in 2004, almost 3 years ago. But it's amazing to see how the place has turned around. And, you know, they're back. The restaurants are back. The lodging is back. They are open for business. So if you ever want to try the Gulf Coast, Panama City, Destin, Fort Walton Beach, Navarre, Pensacola, Gulf Shores, Orange Beach, any of those places, you can't go wrong.
I'll put in a plug for Miramar Beach in the Destin area. That's one of our favorite destinations.
And for folks who have not visited the Gulf Coast of the United States, all I can say is you're missing some nice territory. It really is a nice place to go down. James, when you take vacation, as you just did, are you able to really take vacation and just get away from the work mindset? Can you really completely get away from it?
I really can, just David, because what I do in a normal day is somewhat staggering, and just to be able to step away from that for a few days. And understand, I love everything I do, but you know, when you're up at 4:50 in the morning and you don't get home until almost midnight, it just, everybody needs a break, even if you love your job. And I think I've got the greatest job in the universe, but everybody needs to step away from that. And yeah, I take the laptop, but I don't have a BlackBerry. And, you know,
okay.
I'm good about getting away from email. I see a lot of people walking the beaches with their BlackBerries checking email. I mean, you know, give me a break. I mean, yeah. When I get back to the room, I'll turn on the MacBook and check the email and post some pictures in the blog and write a few things. But to me, that's refreshing. That's a good part about the deal. So, yeah, I get away, and we had a great time. I came back genuinely feeling rested and relaxed, and I'm ready to go for a whole another year now.
Well, I have a question.
Yes.
James, did you have any impact from our little tropical storm Barry?
Yeah.
What's interesting, on the first day of the hurricane season, we had the tropical storm in the Gulf, and we were on the dry side on the west side. So at that spot, Gulf Shores, Alabama, we had bright sunshine. I mean, hardly a cloud in the sky, not a drop of rain the entire time, but the surf was pretty wild. And, you know, I've never spent a lot of time. I've been to the California beaches, but I've never spent a lot of time there, but I saw some pretty cool surfing. I mean, it looked like I was out there in Hawaii or something. A lot of the guys would get out there and they'd hit those surfboards, and we just sat back and watched them surf for a couple of hours. That was fascinating. And so the surf was wild, but it wasn't, you know, I let our 9-year-old, the youngest, you know, get in the water and let the waves beat on him a little bit and have a little bit of fun. He didn't get too deep out there, but the surf was rough. But other than that, the weather was fine.
The riptide can be a problem.
Yeah.
When you have that.
Yeah, it's pretty dangerous. You know, you get the red flags out there, and you better know what you're doing if you get out there when the surf is rough like that. And those surfer guys know what they're doing. But to my knowledge, there were no drownings during the 5-day stretch we were down there, which is a good thing.
And Barry was a very good thing for folks in the state of Florida and Georgia, which has been pounded with wildfires, having terrible problems down in those states. And all of the rain from Barry really knocked a lot of that down, I understand. 8 inches at Mount Vernon, Georgia, 5 inches in Savannah, even Central Park, New York City, almost 4 inches of rain. So the Atlantic seaboard has gotten quite a soaking out of Barry as well. So it was a good thing for folks in certain parts of the country who needed the rain.
Yep. And for a lot of people adjacent to those areas, the smoke is gone. You know, we had probably 4 or 5 states that dealt with very poor air quality as a result of the smoke coming from those fires. And now that the fires have been squelched, the air quality is much, much better. So while parts of the southeast United States in a serious drought did not get the rain, at least the fires are out. So in a way, it helped everybody.
Good news. Well, we are in the start of hurricane season. James, what are your thoughts about it?
Well, I think that Bill Murray kind of talked about this a little bit last week. You know, the media likes to focus on the seasonal forecast, and, you know, NOAA says we're going to have this many hurricanes, and Bill Gray says we're going to have this many. And those are great, and they do a great job, and especially Dr. Gray's team. I really pay attention to that. But I think we just ought to take them one at a time. And one of the concerns I have, all it takes is one big hurricane to make a big season. You know, you can have 30 storms in a season, but if they're weak tropical storms in the middle of nowhere, it doesn't matter. So, and down there, I got a pretty good sense, David, that people are aware of it. And Ivan and Katrina, very fresh on their minds, and they're pretty ready. And I think the EMA officials are better prepared.
I'd like to think that a lot of people have learned the lesson after Katrina and Ivan, and that we will be better off in terms of the evacuation process, you know, making interstates all one way, all lanes, the shelters, getting them in the right place at the right time. I'd like to think we're going to be a whole lot better off if we do have a big one this year.
Well, I'd like to agree with you, but from a government response perspective, I'm still a little bit nervous. I'm not real sure that we've learned enough of a lesson out of Katrina.
Oh, you're right. I mean, there'll be more goofs and all that, but I think at least the people have a better understanding that, you know, this stuff can be serious, and you better listen to what we have to say, because this stuff is fresh on their minds, and it's going to take a while for the memories and the pictures and the images of the Katrina and the Rita and the Ivan and the Dennis-type storms to fade away in their minds. It'll be fresh for a while.
Let me ask both of you guys a tropical question since we're talking tropics. We've had already a storm just right out of the gate as we started hurricane season. James, you in the past have said that the Gulf was kind of churning, kind of active, waters warming up and this sort of thing. Do you see this as a possible indication just right out of the gate that we had a storm, that this might be a pretty active season?
Well, I think there's a lot of latent heat energy stored up in the Gulf. You know, you look down there at the Yucatan Channel, you got these mid-80s, the SSTs down there. Now, on the coast, they're still running around 79 or 80. They're not quite there yet. But the other thing I don't see, and maybe Brian has looked into this more closely, I don't see that vast dust layer we had last year. Do you, Brian, out over the Atlantic Basin?
No, I sure don't. And I was looking at the sea surface temperatures, SSTs, and it seems like the Western Caribbean is also quite warm.
Well, and we know what that could mean, too, don't we?
Well, and actually, Barry began more in the Western Caribbean than in the Gulf. It moved into the Gulf, and that was actually a tropical storm, and then as it moved toward the west coast of Florida, it was downgraded to a depression. So it really did have its beginnings in those warmer waters. So it's going to be interesting to see how this season does progress. But I wanted to add that I think James is right. We need to take storms one at a time. And you know, the thing is that every part of the coastline from Brownsville to Maine through Florida and all up the East Coast, all of it is susceptible to hurricanes.
Hello?
And it really doesn't matter whether you have 30 or you have that one. It's the one that affects you that's the one that's important. And I know in Alabama, when I went to the coast to Gulf Shores for Hurricane Ivan, I was especially pleased that on the Tuesday before Ivan came ashore early Thursday morning, that there was almost no cars on the Gulf Shores island down there. And that showed people were really taking it seriously. And I think things, Katrina, Rita, Ivan, are all pretty fresh in everybody's mind. And I hope whether the Federal Emergency Management Agency is ready or not, I really get a sense that the local people and the state governments really have done a job of improving their preparedness. And I hope that means that we will be, you know, better if we do have any major storms.
Time will tell. J.B. Elliott joining us a few minutes late. Mr. Elliott, how you doing?
Sorry I'm a little bit late. I'm doing fine, sir.
Well, you have had things going on in your life, but I think you had something you wanted to mention. Maybe talk about temperatures?
Yeah, politics and temperatures.
Oh, okay. How does that work?
This sounds good.
There were two cases that I saw unfold over the years while I was in the U.S. Weather Bureau and the National Weather Service later, and one of those directly involved me, and I got in a bit of trouble. But the first one I want to talk about is the one that did get me in trouble. It was back in the 1970s when a bitter cold wave was invading the southeast U.S., including all of the states. I wrote a story for the Alabama Weather Wire, the NOAA Weather Wire, they called it back in those days, the statewide teletype circuit. Wrote a story about the bitter cold, and it was sort of a regional story. I mentioned some of the problems in other states, and in that story, I mentioned, quote, "Even people in North Florida are shaking in their boots." The president of one of the larger chambers of commerce in Florida saw that story because the Associated Press picked it up and relayed it outside the state of Alabama. The president of the largest chamber of commerce in the state hit the ceiling. He did not call us or the local weather service office. He called the chief of the weather bureau in Washington, D.C. to file a complaint. Read the stuff over the phone to him. The chief, in turn, turned it over to the head of the public service unit in Washington. He, in turn, got hold of the regional director in Fort Worth. The regional director in Fort Worth, in turn, called RMIC in Birmingham and gave him a list of things that I should not do anymore. And one of them was, when I write a story like that, to keep it in state and not write about surrounding states. And he said, shaking in the boots is unbecoming of National Weather Service terminology.
Oh, please.
I've always known J.B. Elliott was a black sheep troublemaker. This just confirms it.
Yeah. You and I were involved in something one night, too, when I mentioned that strong winds had lifted a port-a-john at Montgomery Airport and blew it across the street and hit a car. And I mentioned in the story, hopefully neither one was occupied. And, you know, you read that on the air that night. And the other one I wanted to mention, back in the 1950s or early 60s, Fraser, Colorado, we've all heard of Fraser, Colorado, was often the coldest spot in the nation. Almost every day it was, in wintertime, it was one of the stations mentioned as a cold spot. And the Weather Service has always issued a temperature and precipitation tables, numerous cities around the U.S. with highs, lows, and forecasts. And down at the bottom, they put the extremes, the highest in the country and the lowest in the country. So Fraser became a household word because of that. The Pueblo Chamber of Commerce got upset about that and said that was hurting business in Colorado for them to have the reputation of often being the coldest spot in the country. The Pueblo Chamber of Commerce contacted the head of the Weather Service, or U.S. Weather Bureau then, I guess it was, in Washington, D.C., and complained. The Weather Service yielded, and they put out a memorandum that no longer would they include the lowest temperature in the country in the lower 48 states unless the elevation was below 8,500 feet, and the town or community that was reporting that low had to have a population of more than 1,000. They did make exceptions for such noteworthy sites as Death Valley for the highs, but even that is not used unless it's 120 or hotter. And so the Pueblo Chamber of Commerce got the Weather Service to politically yield to not report extremely bitter cold temperatures. Of course, they said if a TV meteorologist or someone wanted to dig out the data, they could find colder temperatures in other places. And until this day, the coldest temperature reported on the bottom of that report every day is not necessarily the lowest temperature in the country. And I'm very bad about digging those out.
Isn't that amazing? Who says there isn't politics embedded in weather?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Just amazing. Yes. Well, speaking of that very topic, some people in the news I thought I would mention. Michael Griffin, the administrator of NASA, he has been catching it for comments he made. He said just a few days back in late May, quote, he was asked by NPR interviewing him about global warming. And his response, just two sentences, very simple and short, has erupted a firestorm. He said, quote, I have no doubt that a trend of global warming exists. I am not sure that it is fair to say that it is a problem we must wrestle with. End quote. There have been people.
All right.
There have been people demanding that he resign for what he said.
Yeah,
can you believe that?
I'll say something ugly, so I'll let JB say something.
Okay.
He always says something nice.
No, don't. On that Colorado story, I wrote a letter to the Denver Post as an individual, not as a Weather Service employee, and told them if that was going to happen, that Wyoming could complain about Big Piney, and Minnesota could complain about Ely, Minnesota, and International Falls, and eventually we would have to skip all of the colder temperatures.
Yeah.
And they ran the letter on the editorial page of the Denver Post, and their cartoonist drew a picture of a guy reading a thermometer standing on his head.
Where do you draw the line?
JB was an activist in his younger days. I like that.
Well, yeah. I'm thinking about becoming one again.
We still have plenty of them right now.
I think we ought to get JB and that lady at the Weather Channel in a wrestling match or something, you know?
What an idea.
Debate followed by a wrestling match.
Mud wrestling.
Yes. Mud wrestling, yes.
JB Elliott of Weather Brains mud wrestles Heidi Cullen.
That would be fun.
Would be interesting, to say the least. Speaking of interesting, we've got a segment to present for folks this week that I think is, I didn't know much about this to start with, but the more I looked into it, we really started learning some interesting things, and I thought it was something that folks would like to hear about. We really all appreciate, I think it's safe to say, the tremendous benefits we get out of Doppler weather radar. It obviously saves untold numbers of lives every year in this country by helping to warn us of approaching dangerous weather. The NEXRAD system, operated by the National Weather Service, has been in operation now since the mid-1990s. So we asked the question, what's next? Bigger radars that cover even more territory? Well, how about just the opposite? The next big step forward in hazard radar may rest with smaller, less powerful, and less costly radars that look down. They could mean even earlier warning for tornadoes and severe thunderstorms. It's a WeatherBrains Extra for you this time. We'll call it Low Down Radar. A two-month test of these new radars concludes June 10th at four locations in tornado-prone Oklahoma. Now, this is all part of CASA, Collaborative Adaptive Sensing of the Atmosphere. CASA is a joint project of four universities, Colorado State University, University of Oklahoma, University of Puerto Rico, and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, which is serving as lead institution. Now, what's interesting about this is CASA could one day mean a wireless network-style radar system atop a building near you. And we caught up with one of the people helping run CASA. It's Colorado State Electrical and Computer Engineering Professor V. Chandra Chandrasekhar.
Yeah, my people call me Professor Chandra.
I understand now why they call you that. People in our audience have heard about Doppler radar for many years. Are these radars that you're working with the same principle, or what's different about them? I know that they look down. What does that mean?
What it means is the current-day radars, they are good radars. There's nothing wrong with them. They have high power, huge dishes, and then they are meant to cover long ranges. As you go to long ranges, one of the things that people are faced with is the beam is much higher compared to the surface of the Earth because of Earth's curvature.
So it's missing what's going on closer to the surface.
That's right. And the National Academy did a study on this, and then it reported that a large portion of the atmosphere where people live is being missed by these radar beams that look high up. So we were looking at, and of course, looking very low is important for a lot of applications, including flooding, looking at severe storms, et cetera, et cetera. And so we were looking at a different paradigm and building a network of smaller, inexpensive radars, and then working with that.
Is the ultimate thinking here that these radars would work in conjunction with the existing wider coverage network?
Well, it could be both. Right now, the way we are progressing is they can work by themselves. That is, it's a network of small reconfigurable radars which will make measurements when and where the user needs are the greatest. And so, however, of course, we have a large invested infrastructure on the current radars. So for a transition period, it could also work as people would call it as gap filler radars. This radar, it's not really a radar per se. It's more of a system, a network of radar systems that is configured so that it can actually respond to user needs very specifically. And it will be what I call as a data pull system. The current day radars are what is called as a data push system. That is, they collect a lot of the data and then give it to the users, and then the users figure out how to use it. Whereas in this new reconfigurable network radar systems, the users can place an order that I wanted to see this particular downburst in much more detail, and then the scan rates and then the frequency at which you look at these things, how often you look at those things, can be adjusted.
You say short range. How short range are we talking about?
Oh, we're talking anywhere between 20 to 40 kilometers as opposed to several hundreds of kilometers.
So if you want to have these over a large area covering a lot of territory, then you're talking about quite a big network.
That's right. So there are lots of paradigms of doing this kinds of things. And the simplest thing you take is today's cell phone network. If you look at the distribution of cell phone networks today, and I have maps of all the cell phone towers in this country, you pretty much go everywhere and you have cell phone coverage, and it's dictated by where people are. So one possible paradigm is to put this on cell phone networks and the rooftops in metropolitan areas. And since this is a much smaller radar, so it leaves less real estate footprint. And also the eventual deployment will be by electronic scanning. So a lot of technological advancements, and then advancements in science of the radar and atmospheric interaction has made a lot of advancements that has made this technology possible.
Are the radars themselves physically smaller compared to a NEXRAD 88D?
Much smaller.
How what size?
In fact, the first deployment with the first instantiation is even bigger, and even that has, I would say, like a 1.2 meter dish right now. Whereas we have a radar at CSU, which is a national test facility, and that's very comparable to NEXRAD in terms of transmit power and size, and that's got a 9-meter antenna. And when you go from that kind of size to a smaller size, many things change, including technology, maintenance, and also if we put in a need for making large number of radars, large number of low-cost, smaller radars, then the economy of marketplace and then mass production, everything takes over. So things would be much different.
You have several systems in test mode right now.
We have a network of these four radars in the Oklahoma Tornado Alley. And then these radars actually reconfigure themselves automatically based on the prevailing weather situation. And then the end user needs. And data is taken to detect tornadoes, and this data is piped directly to the National Weather Service office and the emergency managers and the researchers within our organization so that we could continuously work on this. This test bed we have built is called IP1.
How are they doing?
They're doing very well. They've already seen a couple of tornadoes.
Are you pleased with the results? Do you see a lot more tweaking that needs to be done? What do you see?
Oh, we are very pleased. I mean, the success is even better than what we had expected.
So you see these as having a real future?
Oh, yeah. And we have had, we can't stop the amount of interest that we have on these systems. And it's very national and international. And, of course, we work with companies because we want these technologies to get into the marketplace fairly easily. Well, we have big companies. Since this is sort of a networking of... Each radar typically puts a lot of information. So this also puts out challenges to the computing networking people because it's a network of a whole bunch of nodes where each node puts out a lot of data. It's unlike a large network of little things like you are measuring temperature at just one point. So networking issues are also involved, and then even players like IBM, Raytheon, and then all the way, Weissala. These are all big radar companies, weather companies.
These radars would be useful for detecting more than just tornadoes. Tell me about that.
Yeah, these radars, we have a series of test beds planned. The first one is mainly focused on severe weather because those are high impact events. But floods, are economically, they are devastating. I've read some statistics that are even a lot more devastating than tornado or severe storm damage. So our hope is to raise enough local support to build a test bed for monitoring flooding in the city of Houston. And subsequently, we are in a university setting, so a lot of students are involved. And we are also building a student-led test bed in the island of Puerto Rico, where a lot of tropical storm damage in complex terrain happens. So they are looking at building network of even smaller radars than what I would call as small radars that can operate by themselves without being connected to the grid, and then They will do their own management of whether to transmit signals or whether to heat up to using the solar panels and then how to scan. So it's a very complicated but very fantastic system. And they can be deployed in an adaptive fashion. And a metropolitan city can deploy its own network and then take care of its needs. And even a high-end customer can deploy its own network. Like, let's say, for example, a huge industrial complex wants to do very precision monitoring for itself. It can deploy its own network.
You could put one of these on a building?
Yes. In fact, as we speak, we are trying to put one on a building in downtown Houston.
Do you have a 10-year vision where you would see these radars working right alongside the NEXRAD system, whatever it's designed and operating at that point?
Yes. This is a multi-university partnership, and we have a 13-year vision. So we have this first test bed, then we have a second test bed. The first test bed actually is deployed between midpoint between two NEXRAD systems in Oklahoma. So side by side, we continuously watch what the NEXRAD systems are putting out. So we are working in partnership with them. The National Weather Service and NOAA is a partner in our program. So while we are also trying to demonstrate the value of this network by itself, we are also parallelly seeing if these networks are deployed in between the current NEXRAD, what's the value-added proposition for the current NEXRAD system. So we're evaluating both parts of the story. Now, in terms of you asked about what other uses it has, it's even beyond meteorology. There are tons of homeland security applications. In addition, there is people have shown interest in aircraft tracking from multiple radar systems because this provides a unique outlook. It's a whole. Basically, we're just making measurements close to the ground. It's very simple. And as soon as you say we are building a network close to the ground, there are a lot of people interested in seeing what is happening close to the ground.
Sounds like a tremendous learning experience.
Oh, yeah. This is it's so tremendous. The competition between graduate students to get into this program right now is enormous.
What's next?
Next is to really work on, we are working on some groundbreaking technologies with industries on making the single radars very, very efficient. There will be no mechanical moving parts. All the scanning will be done electronically. So it's a matter of making lighter, better radars that would be going everywhere. Of course, nothing comes for free. One of the important things is to make these things smaller. We have moved from the current day operating frequency of S-band to much higher frequency, which is X-band. The current operating frequency of Weather Service radars is about approximately 3 gigahertz. So we are moving to X-band, which is about 10 gigahertz, or we could even go to 14 gigahertz. When you move there, then the laws of physics change. So, but we have done a lot of research with advanced polarimetry and so on. So we are dealing with all of our advances and knowledge in trying to fix these issues. So it's not without challenges. It's not just technology. There is a parallel fundamental science component dealing with the laws of physics that different frequencies are also involved in this because the radar beams get also absorbed by water, the same principle that is used to heat up water in our microwave. And that absorption increases when you go to higher frequencies, so we got to deal with that. But as soon as you have problems, then you work around systems that can take care of that. That's where the excitement is.
That's Professor Chandra with Colorado State University. Again, the first test bed right now, Oklahoma, after that Houston, and then ultimately to Puerto Rico, where the network will be tested to see how well it handles monitoring floods produced by thunderstorms and hurricanes over complex terrain. So very fascinating system experiment underway. If you'd like to know more about this project, by the way, we have a link to CASA on our website, weatherbrains.com. What do you think about that, guys? One day, just a little mini cellular phone network-style radar system. It might be literally smile you're on Doppler radar somewhere.
Unbelievable. Now,
I like the fact that the beam is so low.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where right now, you know, we're looking at some thunderstorm on radar. In fact, even as I speak, I'm looking at a storm, and the radar beam is 6,500 feet off the ground. So the lower, the better. You know, that's where people live.
Well, in television meteorology, James, you have mentioned more times than once about the fact that you're really not able to see what's happening at ground level, right?
Yep. And I don't think people understand the way it works. And that's a big limitation. And that's why the spotters are so important. And that's why this kind of technology is so important. So maybe we'll get one in our building here at the TV station. You know, he's putting them on these rooftops here. Maybe we can fit one up here.
These things may pop up on top of a fast food restaurant or something, maybe on top of the Golden Arches or something someday. You never know.
I wonder, you know, he's talking about X-band stuff up at, 10 gigahertz or so.
Right.
I wonder if there will be any study to determine if that's, you know, going to be, that RF is going to be a problem for humans. I think they operate at such a low power and the pulse is so short, it shouldn't be a problem.
Well, there's going to be a lot more RF floating through society. We know that.
Yep.
Maybe one on top of the storm track or OSU's car.
There you go. That'd be good.
Maybe put a helmet on top of Brian Peters and, you know, see one just sweeping around on top of him.
Helmet radar. That would be good.
Yes.
what would he need? He needs a parabolic dish on his helmet and the flashing red light on top of that. So, and there's a tornado warning.
But can you imagine whatever the NEXRAD system is doing, you know, a few years from now to be able to see what a conventional NEXRAD radar is seeing and then go in, so to speak, into high-res, close-up, down-at-the-earth mode with one of these new wireless network systems just to help verify and compare? It could be a tremendous bonanza of information.
Well, I bet you, 50 years from now, the people doing weather, operational meteorology, they'll look back, you know, at 2007 technology and find it probably very laughable. So that's part of the progress.
Which brings up the issue, 50 years from now, what will James Spann look like when he's anchoring the weather?
I'll be resting comfortably in my cemetery hole out there somewhere.
Oh, stop it. Anyway.
Good grief. I'll be 101 years old.
You'll be doing your usual weather forecast routine.
Yeah, I've got a tornado warning here.
I'll be 125.
And I'm not going to say how old I am, but I know somebody's coming up on a birthday.
Yep.
Oh, James.
Oh, boy.
Probably going to have to do a special report on Spann.
That's right. You know, it was great forecasting the weather for the Civil War days, you know. JB covered the Revolutionary War, so it could be worse.
Everybody here,
I got here before kudzu and mosquitoes.
Everybody here is just timeless, I guess is what it boils down to. Wanted to say thanks to a few folks who have emailed us the past few days here at WeatherBrains. Peter Blattner in Chicago, Illinois, thanks for contacting us. Also, thanks to Stephen Pridmore. And a hello to Rick Ackland Snow, emailing us from Suffolk, England. We've got folks listening all over the place. All right, get your books out. It's WeatherBrains 101 class time again as Brian Peters, the distinguished Professor Peters, that's it, explains wet bulb temperatures. Hold on.
WeatherBrains 101 with Professor Peters.
Temperature describes how hot or cold the air is, but there are so many temperatures. Dry bulb temperature, wet bulb temperature, dew point temperature. So just what is what out there? Well, the dry bulb temperature is the actual temperature of the air. We usually shorten that to just temperature. The wet bulb temperature is the temperature air will cool to when water is evaporated into unsaturated air. When the air is saturated, the dew point temperature, the wet bulb temperature, and the actual air temperature are all the same. In unsaturated air, the dew point is always lower than the wet bulb temperature. As air is saturated, the temperature decreases while at the same time the dew point increases. Wet bulb cooling can occur at any level of the atmosphere. In a thunderstorm, it can result in damaging wind. Sometimes with summer thunderstorms, the effect is just a cool breeze. Or it can turn liquid precipitation into frozen precipitation in the winter season. A quick technique that many forecasters use to determine the wet bulb temperature is called the one-third rule. The technique is to first find the dew point depression. That's the difference between the temperature and the dew point. Then take this number and divide it by 3. Subtract your result from the actual air temperature. You now have an approximation of the wet bulb temperature. This technique does not give you the exact wet bulb temperature, but it does provide a pretty close approximation. It's often important to know the wet bulb temperature in the boundary layer, that layer closest to the ground, in the winter weather situations. Evaporational cooling can change the temperature profile just enough so that rain changes over to snow, sleet, or freezing rain. For example, suppose the temperature is 37 degrees Fahrenheit with a dew point of 18 degrees Fahrenheit. Using the one-third rule, the temperature would cool to 31 degrees Fahrenheit, so now we'd be below freezing. Well, that's WeatherBrains 101 for this edition. If you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Thank you, Professor Peters. Well, hey, for the folks in Topeka, Kansas, this week marks a dark period in weather history. It's when they learned that a legend that said their town was safe from tornadoes was put to the test. This was back in 1966. And during this week in 1953, residents in New England were stunned by an event they thought they'd never have to worry about. More from Bill Murray, who's got This Week in Weather History.
Let's look back at some interesting weather history for the week of June 5th through the 11th. And it was back in 2001 that Allison proved that a tropical storm could be just as costly as the worst hurricanes. The storm formed on June 5th in the Gulf of Mexico. It made landfall near Houston with top winds of 60 miles an hour, but the main impact would come from flooding rains. Almost 36 inches of rain fell at Greens Bayou near Houston, and that's the third highest rainfall total in U.S. history, behind the 45 inches that fell from 1979's Tropical Storm Claudette and the 40 inches that fell at Thrall, Texas in 1921. Flooding of biblical proportions affected parts of the Houston area. Now, Allison would become the costliest tropical storm in U.S. history. Damage is near $2.5 billion. The storm meandered across the Gulf and all the way up the east coast of Massachusetts over a 14-day period. 35 people died in the storm. Now, June 8th is a famous day in weather history. It was on that date back in 1966 when the people of Topeka, Kansas got a rude surprise as an F5 tornado roared into their town. You see, they believed a legend that Burnett's Mound protected their city from tornadoes. Famed newscaster Bill Curtis got his big break on this day when he broadcast live warnings on television station WIBW. The Topeka tornado was the first in U.S. history to cause $100 million in damage. Now, it was back on June 8, 1953, that an F5 tornado struck Flint, Michigan, killing 116 people, and that's the last time that 100 or more people died from a single tornado in the U.S. Now, there was a weather unit in the Weather Bureau that would go on to become the National Severe Storms Forecast Center and what we know today as the Storm Prediction Center, but it was in infancy at that time. But their staff accurately predicted the outbreak and issued an excellent public tornado forecast. Now, the very next day, New England's deadliest tornado disaster occurred when an F4 tornado roared across the northern part of Worcester, Mass. The tornado was spawned from the same storm that had caused the Flint disaster. Now, this tornado was not forecast by the Severe Weather Unit because forecasters there and general climatology said that a major tornado could not occur in New England. They could not have been more wrong. Back in 1972, it was on June 9th that residents in Rapid City, South Dakota, had scant minutes to flee for their lives as the Canyon Lake Dam gave way, sending a wall of water through the city. 238 people died in the disaster. And it was on June 10, 1752, when Ben Franklin performed his famous experiment, flying a kite in a thunderstorm to determine if lightning and electricity were related. Luckily, Mr. Franklin lived to tell the story. Back on June 10, 1929, French meteorologists made an important milestone in weather history, sending up the first radio-signed weather balloon. And we do that today from stations all over the globe twice a day. That's This Week in Weather History.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bill Murray. A personal note, a Weather Brains crew member, Kevin Selly, is taking a little bit of Weather Brains sick leave. We are extending our thoughts, best thoughts and wishes for Kevin to be able to make a speedy recovery and hopefully be back with us soon. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. If you'd like to leave a voicemail, we've got a toll-free telephone number you may use for doing that, 1-888-247-8627. That's 1-888-247-8627. For the Weather Brains crew, James Spann, J.B. Elliott, and Brian Peters, I'm David Black. We do thank you for listening and hope you'll be able to join us next time. Weather Brains is copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Adios! All right, guys, we're heading back to the coast to those places Spann talked about.
That's it, I'm going to stay in Chicago where it's cooler.
Sounds like a neat trip.
They're blowing all his money at the Apple store, probably.
Yeah.
Yes.
What are you going to buy me?
I haven't bought you anything.
Thank you very little.
But I have some nice new Bose earbuds.
You know, I think I'm the only non-MacBook Pro person in the group just about. I'm starting to feel left out.
Get on the stick, David.
Come on,
it's
man.
It's wonderful.
Just need that Professor Peters charge card.
You know, it was really interesting when I flew to Cleveland. I came through O'Hare. You know, you can't go from Birmingham to Cleveland, and it was very interesting. A thunderstorm kept us on the taxiway.
Ooh. For a long time?
It was about 45 minutes. The pilot put an announcement out that they shut down any takeoffs to the east, and if anybody wanted to come up to the cockpit and see the radar, they were welcome.
Cool.
I was the only one who went up there.
Wow.
And ended up chatting with the pilot and co-pilot for about, 12, 15 minutes. Looking at radar.
Confirms you're a weather geek.
I think so.
You didn't press any buttons, did you?
No, I didn't press any buttons.
Okay, good.
Kept his hands to his side at all times.
Yeah, good.
Very well, guys. Enjoyed it.
All right, boys. That was a great show.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Y'all be good.
All right, bye-bye.
Welcome back, James.
Thank you.
Bye.